The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Medievalist. And I want to continue what we were dealing with the last time in terms of the nationalist and liberation movement launched by the Cossacks, the Orthodox Church, the leadership of Bogdan Khmelnytsky. Now, we need to move on here, and this might be a two-part series on his most significant successor, and that is the equally famous Hetman Ivan Mazepa. And now we're moving in. We're at the beginning of the 18th century, really, when Mazepa comes into his own. But unlike Khmelnytsky, Mazepa will fail. And when Mazepa fails, Ukraine becomes an appendage of Russia, and then an appendage of the Soviet Union. And only in recent years will finally gain some kind of independence. An independence that, in my opinion, has been a little less than a complete disaster. So, we're dealing in this show with two nationalist heroes. Two nationalist heroes of Ukraine. Two nationalist heroes that have a history of inspiring other nationalist movements, not the least of which, the one in Ireland, with Khmelnytsky and Mazepa. But like a lot of what happened in Ireland up until the 1920s, Mazepa will fail, and Ukraine will be plunged into what is more or less a colonial position under the Russian Empire, and then later on under the Soviet Empire. So after the death of Khmelnytsky, the next significant person is the Hetman Ivan Vyakhovsky. He's elected in 1657. And you know, what's going to happen here, and you're going to see this a lot, that, you know, the Ukrainians have more options in their nationalist struggle than the Irish really ever did. I mean, the Irish had gone to Spain and France at one time or another. The Ukrainians are better off in this respect. And the first act of Vyakhovsky is to go to Sweden. Sweden is going to play an extremely important role in Mazepa's victory, and the defeat of Charles X of Sweden will also be the defeat of Mazepa and of Ukrainian independence. But you need to realize that the Cossack movement throughout Ukraine is deeply divided. As I said before, you have some who are very pro-Russian. You have some who are very pro-Turkish. You have some who are very pro-Polish. Now, with Vyakhovsky, you have a faction that is now pro-Swedish, as Sweden has really manifested itself as one of the world's great powers. But there's a pro-Russian faction that seeks to denounce him and will cause him a tremendous amount of trouble. In fact, the Russians at this time, the rather unsettled period, the middle of the 17th century, will have its agents throughout Ukraine doing everything in its power to unseat Vyakhovsky. And what begins to happen is that, you know, again, this is never meant to be an anti-Russian a tirade like you hear among so many Ukrainian nationalist people. And I want to say again that, that the Russian motivation here is twofold. The Russian motivation is to maintain a supply of Ukrainian grain and vodka, which is generally of higher quality than in Russia, as well as to make sure that Ukraine can never become a staging ground for another power. It's interesting to note that the British government had the same thing in Ireland. We don't want this. We don't want Ireland to become a staging ground for the French or the Spanish. And so this isn't, you know, an anti-Ukrainian movement. This is a simple matter of real politic, but real politic that truly has oppressed the Ukrainian population, its peasantry, and its Orthodox Church. And so as Vyhovsky is moving towards Sweden, the Russians are increasing their forces within Cossack territory. And the more this happens, the less powerful the pro-Russian faction in Ukraine will become. In 1658, something very significant happens. Ukraine becomes a part of the Polish and Lithuanian Commonwealth. The Treaty of Hadyk will join Poland, Lithuania, and Ukraine in a way that's meant to nullify the Treaty of Pereslavl. And the treaty that the Poles and the Lithuanians are willing to give to the Ukrainians to control, the purpose behind this is to control Russia, to control Sweden, to control the Germans, to control even the Hungarians. The idea here is that this is to nullify the Treaty of Pereslavl, and therefore is meant to make the Ukrainians happy, to make them a loyal part of this movement, and so Ukraine is promised full fiscal and military freedom. The Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church are treated as equals, but the Uniates, who we had discussed the last time, are banned. And this is something that the Polish government, and a lot of Uniates don't know about this, that the Polish government was quite willing to be a part of. The Uniates are nullified, but the Roman Church and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church are now equal. And under this union, you have a tremendous amount of money coming into Ukraine. Vyhovsky's policies are extremely successful. And you have, again, something that Ukrainians really, and I think the Irish too, really excel in, and that is education. The building of schools, the discipline necessary to do the proper learning to make your society a better place. And under this union, you have an explosion of education, literacy, printing, universities, and seminaries. But needless to say, 1659, this treaty provokes a war with Russia. But the Russians will lose badly to this coalition. Nevertheless, Russian agents are continually operating on Ukrainian territory, talking about the benefits of a union with Russia. Vyhovsky will be shot, will be executed by the Poles in 1664. There were rumors probably spread by the Russians that Vyhovsky is opposed to this treaty and wants to get out of it, and through some kind of very complicated machinations of the Russian government, really what is a national hero, a true nationalist, will be shot by the Poles in 1664. Afterwards, the Russians will then force Ukraine to sign a new treaty, also called the Treaty of Pereslavl. This is what makes Russian-Ukrainian relations, even today, very difficult to understand. The initial Treaty of Pereslavl, we talked about last time, was very moderate. It promised a great degree of freedom to the Ukrainian population. But this new treaty, also called Pereslavl, and almost designed to confuse the average Ukrainian person, is really an anti-Ukrainian treaty. It basically nullifies any kind of Ukrainian or Cossack independence. And then, you know, this is a treaty that will then justify the real problematic nature of the relations between Russia and Ukraine, and that is economic exploitation. My personal view is that relations between Russia and Ukraine could have been very positive had not the Russian aristocracy viewed Ukraine, I mean, rightly so, as a very fertile, very literate, very hardworking place that then can be exploited and have that cash, have that money, have that liquor, have that grain be exported to Russia. And that becomes Russian policy even into the Soviet era. So here again you have, you know, what could have been a friendly Orthodox alliance is destroyed by the Russian aristocracy. And this is going to be the problem. It isn't so much that these guys woke up one morning and said, I'm going to go kill me a Ukrainian. It's that this aristocracy viewed Ukraine as a cash cow to supply. And remember, Russia is coming out of the time of troubles with some very severe economic problems. The Ukrainian issue is very important as a means of exploiting her for the sake of taking her grain as well as her labor. So this second Pereslav Treaty is meant to justify what's going to happen from here on in, right up until World War One, the economic exploitation of the Ukrainian region. And I want to say that this denial of Ukrainian culture has an economic root. It's not then so much that, I mean, if Ukrainians and Russians are the same people, it's not economic exploitation, it's not colonialism, it's just our brother people assisting us. But when you talk about them as two different cultures, what you're talking about is colonial exploitation, and that's exactly what it was. I will reiterate this again and again, that the Russians could have built strong brotherly relations with the Ukrainians on the basis of equality, which would have benefited both peoples and the Orthodox Church, but the aristocracy of Russia, and then later on, the mentality of Peter the First, Peter the Great, will nullify that. And Russian approaches to Ukraine are going to be violent, ignorant, and very ham-handed. In 1660, given this Russian exploitation of Ukraine, another war will break out with Poland. The 1660 war will again see a defeat of Russian arms. And because of this, the Cossacks will then go over to Poland. The Cossacks will continue to play this game of going to whatever side of the European world can maintain their independence. The treaty that eventually will come out of the 1660 war will divide Ukraine between the right and the left banks of the Dnieper. Right and left bank refers to a view from the north. So the right bank will be a western part under Polish rule, and the left bank will be that part largely under Russian rule. So that means you have two Ukraines. You have two Ukraines based on right or left banks of the Dnieper River, and two sets of Cossacks, and two sets of leaders here in the 1670s and the 1680s. 1668, Russia will hit Poland very hard and defeat her as a way to compensate. Poland will then take over much of Ukraine, and one of the hetmans at the time, Tetyaria, will decide that really, you know, the only place to go is Turkey. In 1666, another hetman, Doroshenko, will invade Poland. during unrest that is taking place in Poland in that particular period of time. But as it always happens, these hetmans, they rely on allies, particularly the Muslims, whether they be Turks or whether they be Crimean Tartars. The Crimean Tartars are actually vassals of the Turks. But it doesn't take much to bribe these guys to abandon the Ukrainian cause. But before the Tartars will abandon ship, Ukraine will again invade Poland under Doroshenko and take a great degree of her territory. This coalition, the Tartars will eventually left Doroshenko, and then Doroshenko is then forced to go to Turkey. And since Russia and Turkey are enemies, Russia is forced to then invade Cossack territory. I mean, I know this is complicated history, but it must be understood, because we're talking about the clash of the nationalist idea versus the idea of empire. Whether it be Turkish, Polish, Russian, but we have one national group here. I mean, at least one national group here, and that is the Ukrainians. So understanding nationalist political theory is one thing. Nationalist political practice, that's another matter. But nationalist political practice is exactly what we're dealing with here. And once Russia attacks the Cossack forces, you have many divisions among the Cossack armies. The Cossack opinion, I guess, at the time is basically Poland is too weak to worry about. They're not going to help us at all. The Russians are out of the question. At the moment, we have one choice, and that's to go to Turkey. Now, it sounds good to say that, but Turkish occupation of Ukrainian territory simply means that Islam is imposed in certain areas and that these beautiful Ukrainian women are then taken as slaves back to Istanbul. So the Turkish option becomes immensely unpopular very quickly. And this occurs in 1672. And the Turks make themselves absolutely obnoxious in Ukrainian territory. And during this period of time, you have another problem that is really tearing apart the Cossack movement, and that is class warfare. Those Cossacks that are basically settled, that have lands and even serfs of their own, that have social standing, that, by the way, will be represented by Mazepa. And then those Cossacks that are poorer, that are more populist, that are more ethnically radical and even anarchist in their basic point of view. And in 1668, Russia is going to attempt to invade the country again and eliminate the Turkish presence. Because of the Turkish presence in Ukraine, Poland and Russia will join forces. And this is pretty rare. And they will join forces 1667, 1668, and they will divide Ukraine between the two of them. And so the patriotic movement, yet again, has no other choice but to go to Turkey. So people like Doroshenko, people like even right bank, left bank, military leaders realize that there's one goal. An independent Ukraine, not dependent on any surrounding power. We may use surrounding powers, but we can never be dependent on the surrounding powers. Someone else is elected and reigns from 1672 to 1687. A very, maybe a genius, a very pious man, Ivan Samoilovich, who is moderately pro-Russian. And like Mazepa, he will basically support the upper classes of the Cossack movement and the Cossack aristocracy. But one of the things he does that makes him a very obnoxious figure in Ukrainian history is that he essentially sells off the Ukrainian Orthodox bishops that we talked about some time ago that group that derives from the Patriarch of Jerusalem will sell them to the Russian Orthodox Church and invite Russian Orthodox bishops and institutions into Ukraine. But Samuilovich has a strategy. His strategy is going to be mirrored by others later on, but one element of it is that, you know, the last thing that Ukrainian patriots want to see in the early 1680s is yet another coalition between Russia and Poland against Turkey. A coalition of Russia and Poland against Turkey would be absolutely disastrous because there is absolutely no way that the Cossacks can defeat a coalition of Poland and Russia on the one hand. And we already know through very bitter and very violent experience that the Turks do not care about Ukraine and really view Ukraine as a place of economic exploitation. And the Turks really have a thing for these dark-haired, blue-eyed Ukrainian women, really some of the most beautiful in Europe. And so, you know, as prizes to the Sultan and to his generals, you know, bringing a bevy of these back from Ukraine is really considered the greatest of all gifts. And the fact is that the Jewish mafia in Russia is doing the exact same thing right now with the exact same group of people. And bringing these beauties back to Israel or to the Czech Republic or to New York City or anywhere else where this white slavery is occurring goes back many, many, many centuries. And the Ukrainian woman is really this extraordinary mix of the Nordic and the Mediterranean. So you have this light-skinned, very dark hair, blue-eyed beauty that really, in my opinion, really can't be paralleled anywhere else in Europe. It's a very exotic mix, and this exotic mix has turned on a lot of men, from the nomadic Turks in the Middle Ages to the Turkish sultans in this era to the Jewish oligarchs in 2009. And so this has been an ongoing problem for Ukrainian life for a very long time. But the one thing that happens to some extent to Samuilovich's benefit is that the Russians fail to really move successfully against the Turks in Ukraine. The problem is that the Ukrainian Cossacks are made the scapegoat and are then punished by Russian arms. And what's going on throughout this period of time is that the occupying power, whether it be Poland, Turkey, or Russia, is interested in a few things. They're interested, number one, in using Ukrainian manpower against their enemies. Number two, they're interested in having a sex with as much of these Ukrainian women as possible. Number three, they're interested in really the literacy and intelligence of the Ukraine. You know, the literacy of Ukraine is far higher than the literacy in Russia or in Turkey. And they're interested, lastly, in the tremendous grain, grain crops of Ukraine, as well as the beet sugar, where the sugar of this part of the world is made from, and there's a lot of money to be made in all of that. And although some of the crops have changed, a lot of the players remain pretty much the same. The same movements. Okay, that is our introduction. And I know it's been complicated, but you know that's the nature of accurate historical analysis. We're talking about the struggle to maintain an independent Ukrainian culture against attacks from all sides. And what you notice is that all of these alliances, if they succeed at all, succeed only in the short term. And unfortunately, the lesson really is, unfortunately, that ethnic groups must depend on their own people in order to win real victories. It's a sad reality, but it is a reality. So, when we come back from this break, we are going to deal now with the man who is still being debated every day in Russia and Ukraine, is being debated every day in the Ukraine. And trust me, I know this firsthand, having lived among the Ukrainians for so many years. Ivan Mazepa is the inheritor of all of this. He's going to try to make sense out of it. He will fail, but he will still remain a hero. And when we come back, we're going to deal with his contribution, and then we're going to be able to wrap this up. So we won't need a second installment. We could deal with the Mazepa issue here just in this single show. So my listeners, hang in there. We'll be right back.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
I want to welcome everyone back to the Orthodox Medievalist, and we are dealing with the idea of nationalism, national liberation, and the practice of national liberation. And in our case, dealing with Ukraine, the end of the 17th, beginning of the 18th century. And we deal with this era because we are leading up to one of the most famous men in Ukrainian history, and one of the most famous men in the history of nationalism as a political view, and that is the hetman of the Cossacks, Ivan Mazepa. He is hetman on the left bank of Ukraine, and he begins, I mean, he is an aristocrat, as so many of the hetmans are. And he begins his career relatively loyal to Peter the Great, Peter the First. As you know from listening to this show, I'm hostile to Peter the First and the government that he created. I am pro-Russian up until Peter the First, and I have a tendency to be very critical of Russia after Peter the First. And I think that there is a huge schism there that Peter the Great, really the entire 18th century, right up until Catherine the Great, Catherine the Second, really opened up and created. And I know Solzhenitsyn agrees with me. I spent a lot of time writing on this topic. Solzhenitsyn agrees with me in this respect, that Peter the First and his successors did a lot of damage to the ancient cultural tradition of Russia. The battle here is going to be between Peter the Great, a ferocious figure, an amoral figure, a humongous figure, not only politically, but physically. The man was almost 7 feet tall. The man slept only a few hours a night. The man was so powerful. The man's mind was so powerful that he was able to comprehend dozens of separate political and technical problems simultaneously, and then dictate the secretary's answers to these problems one after another after another after another. So Peter the Great is no one to discount. Peter the Great is an extraordinary, however, an evil individual. Peter the Great wanted two things. And sometimes he couldn't decide which one he wanted first. He wanted to destroy Sweden because he needed the Baltics and he needed the Baltic Sea. Problem with the Baltic Sea is that it's awful cold. And so that would have benefits, but only limited benefits. The other thing he wanted, I think, is far more valuable, and that is the Black Sea. The Black Sea, of course, is a part of the Ukrainian world. So he had a northern strategy, and he had a southern strategy. And the Cossacks, as far as Peter the Great is concerned, the Cossacks were central to both strategies. But as far as we're concerned, Peter the Great obsessed really about taking the Black Sea. Either getting rid of the Cossacks or at least having loyal Cossacks to do his fighting and finally destroying the Turks from Europe and that part of Asia. This used to be the old stomping ground of the Khazars. So it's a very valuable, very powerful area. Mazepa, an aristocrat, really starts his career as a fanatical supporter of Peter the Great. He is involved in Peter's campaigns throughout the Black Sea area dozens of times in the early part of his reign. No one was more loyal to Peter the Great than Hetman Ivan Mazepa. But Mazepa and some of his followers begin to notice something. They begin to notice that there's a lot of Cossacks dying. There's a lot of battles. There's a lot of money that the Ukrainians have to ship up to Peter to finance all of these wars. But the Cossacks are getting nothing in return. And the more that the Cossacks fight and die and suffer for Peter the Great's plans, the less that they're getting. In fact, Peter the Great, because he has no moral code, he is a Freemason, he is not a Christian, he's none of these things. He will suppress the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church in 1701, and he will not be replaced. It will become a state church in the sense of a bureaucratic church. You know, Peter the Great is not a Christian man. Peter, you know, the more Cossacks die, the more Peter demands from the Cossack forces. And so it's not a surprise that the Cossack elements throughout Ukrainian and even Turkish territory begin really worrying about Mazepa's policy towards Peter the Great. And there are rebellions all over the place. And I want to make it clear that in this era, Cossacks are anarchists. Cossacks are Ukrainians and Slavs, generally speaking. There's a few Turks and Persians, you know, mixed in there. But generally speaking, they are Slavs, they are Orthodox, they love Jesus Christ, but they are anarchists politically. They are what we might call today national anarchists. They are the very, the apogee of the concept of national anarchy. So there are rebellions against these guys all over the place. And Mazepa makes himself very unpopular. And for a long time, Mazepa will be a very unpopular figure in Ukraine. And the only thing that keeps him going is the diplomatic and military support of Peter the Great. Anti-Russian Cossacks begin to do their best to unseat Mazepa, even going so far as making up rumors and sending them to St. Petersburg saying that Mazepa is, you know, he's disloyal, he hates you, all this kind of stuff. But Peter doesn't believe it. Peter says, if there's one man in this empire that's loyal to me, it's him. If there's one man that I trust more than anybody in my empire, it is Hetman Ivan Mazepa. There are many rival hetmans throughout this very large and fertile area. Ivanenko is one of them who in 1691 he will raise an army of Tartars in an attempt to overthrow Mazepa and fail. But there's somebody else who shows up, a Cossack leader who in many ways really embodies the best of the Cossack Christian mentality, and his name is Simon Pali. And Simon Pali is somebody who has a problem with Russia, has a problem with Peter the Great, and has a problem with Mazepa. And as a result of that, he is invited by Poland to repopulate the right bank of Ukraine, which, you know, right bank meaning the western part that's under nominal Polish control, that because of all of these wars and battles and the Turks and everybody else has largely been depopulated. Polia is requested by the Polish government to repopulate these areas. And he's willing to do so, except that he refuses to listen to anybody except the Cossack Council of Elders. We talked about this institution last time. Remember, the Polish Constitution had a weak monarch, but an immensely strong, if not absolutely dominant, landowning class. The Cossacks refused to deal with any landowning class, and certainly not an Orthodox landowning class. So Simon Pale is quite willing to repopulate this part of the right bank, but he certainly is not going to listen to Polish landlords. And so eventually, after many attacks on him from these landlords, all of whom, by the way, have private armies, Pale will go to Russia in hopes to eventually finally destroy Poland and get them out of the way altogether. Of course, that's not going to happen until the time of Catherine the Great, where Poland will be divided between or among Austria, Prussia, and Russia. But here's the problem. Ivan Mazepa is an aristocrat. He is an elitist, you know, in the positive sense of the word. I mean, he believes that only really your Cossack Orthodox aristocracy can run a country. But Polia, in his experiences in Poland, he becomes an anarchist, he becomes a Christian anarchist, and a total Cossack populist. And what Polia does in his activities in on the right bank is organize a regular succession of popular rebellions against the Polish aristocracy. And as a result of this, I mean, he's attacking Mazepa. He's saying, you know, Mazepa is part of the rich crowd. You know, he's not a guy we need. He's close to this lunatic Peter the First. And by the way, a lot of Russian Orthodox people were convinced that Peter was possessed. Peter was possessed by demons. That would explain his tremendous energy. And his, you know, this was a popular view. And so a man who was associated with Peter the First was someone to be rejected. So Polia becomes a very popular figure. Polia becomes a man who is your great Christian nationalist anarchist, operating on the right bank of the Dnieper River. Eventually, of course, he makes a lot of enemies, both Russian and Polish, and Mazepa will eventually be paid to destroy him. In 1704, Polia will be defeated by Mazepa, and Ukraine, for the first time in a very long time, will be united. Left bank and right bank of the Dnieper will be united under the scepter of Hetman Ivan Mazepa. Now, Mazeppa is a well-educated man. He's highly literate. He's fluent in many languages. He's a devout Orthodox Christian, and by the way, is very interested in what's going on in Italy, in parts of France in terms of the Renaissance. So sometimes the Baroque architecture of Ukraine is sometimes called Cossack Baroque or even Mazeppa Baroque. So this guy is not a half-wit. But Mazeppa is able to convince Peter the Great that a strong Ukraine under his scepter is nothing but good for Russia. We can control the Turks, we can control the Poles, and we can control the Black Sea trade for you. And Peter buys it. And Peter, throughout his reign, up until, we'll get to this in a minute, Peter will say that there is nobody more valuable to me in this land than Mazeppa. Mazeppa believes, as I said before, that only the aristocracy really has a right to govern. But something happens that's going to change the face of Europe, that's going to change the face of the world, and that is the military genius of the king of the very young king of Sweden, Charles the Tenth. Charles the Tenth is involved by himself, defeating a coalition of Russians, Danes, Poles, and Saxons for control of Northern Europe, and he's winning. It's clear that this young man is a military genius. Nobody, including Peter the Great, denied that Charles the Tenth was anything less than a military genius. Charles the Tenth defeated Peter the Great over and over again in the mists and the swamps of northwestern Russia. But, you know, typical of Peter, what he ends up doing is dragooning as many Cossacks as he can to operate as slave labor to rebuild his defenses and his forces in that very nasty part of the world of the extreme northwestern part of Russia. So thousands of Cossack slaves, and they are slaves, will perish because Peter the Great is using them to rebuild his defenses so that he could finally be able to face Charles II. Peter is exhausting the Ukrainian economy. He is sucking every penny, every grain of oats and rye and rice and everything else and beet sugar and everything else that's so important to the economy. He's sucking it out of Ukraine to use for his purposes in the Northern War. Mazeppa finds himself now in a heap of trouble. He has to make a decision. There is no way that he could permit Cossacks to be murdered in huge numbers as chattel slaves under this demonist Freemason Peter the First. And there's no doubt that even mainstream biographies admit that he was initiated into the Masonic Lodge in Amsterdam. Peter the Great was a high-level Freemason. There's a very good chance that he was an open Satanist because he did have black masses and he did call himself the black patriarch of Russia and all the, you know, I mean, Peter was, you know, he was an alcoholic, and he may well have been possessed. So what is Mazeppa to do? Slowly but surely, he approaches Charles the Tenth. And you can imagine the stress. If I cross Peter, and if I don't get away with it, I will be tortured to death, and so will all my people. But at the same time, I can't permit my own men to be tortured to death in this rebuilding of Russian defenses around the armies of Charles X. But, you know, Sweden would be one heck of an ally. I mean, number one, everyone's afraid of Charles. Number two, they're too far away to be a real problem. I mean, they can never really occupy Ukraine. And yet, if there's any chance of getting rid of Peter the Great, it's Charles X. So in 1706, Mazeppa makes a fatal move. A move that maybe I would have made, you would have made, an alliance with Charles X of Sweden. As the war continues, Peter demands more and more men and money from Ukraine. Ukraine is broke. Ukraine is bled dry. Charles X wants Peter gone. And he says to Mazeppa, he says to anybody who will listen, if I am able to successfully invade Russia, I will destroy Peter the Great, I will dethrone him, and I will put someone on that throne that's more amenable to me, to the Ukrainians, to anybody else. So Charles kind of has this, you know, we're now 1707, 1708. Charles has spent a lot of money and a lot of blood fighting Peter. He's fought a large coalition of northern European powers. He will move his forces south. Because just like Peter the Great, he thinks that, you know, Ukraine is a promised land. There's nothing but beautiful women and everything grows. You know, there's rich crops and there's nothing but money and the streets are paved with gold and Ukrainians are all brilliant. Kind of the, you know, stereotype that people had. So Charles decides that to resupply his forces, he is going to move south. But there's a problem. By the time he gets to Ukraine, there aren't a lot of Cossacks around. Most of them are dead. Most of them are involved in slave labor in Peter's projects, many of whom have been murdered in wars with Russia and Poland. And the fact is that Mazeppa still has this reputation as being pro-Peter. And the alliance with Charles, regardless of all of this, is made officially. Once Peter the Great gets proof that Mazeppa has turned on him, Peter will send an army into Ukraine, into Mazeppa's capital, a small town called Baturin. And in 1708, Peter the Great will show what kind of a man he is, because he will order the mass slaughter of every living thing in Baturin. Men, women, children, cats, dogs, birds, caterpillars, anything that moves. Anything that is alive will be slaughtered. The Swedes, who I guess apparently do want to help Ukraine, do want to use Ukraine to create a new order in Eastern Europe, are very disappointed with what they find in Ukraine. They find a devastated country with very few Cossacks. And what Cossacks remain are not quite willing to support Mazeppa. Mazeppa just has this aristocratic reputation, and the memory of people like Polya still exists. Mazeppa attempts to create a global alliance against Peter the Great. And what Peter the Great will do in return is engage in a genocidal program just as severe as what Stalin will do later on in the 1930s. Maybe not as scientific. I mean, yeah, they don't have machine guns or you know, poison gas or anything like that. But Peter the Great will do to Ukraine exactly what Stalin will do later on. He will engage in a massive pacification campaign to frighten the Ukrainian population literally to death. And the final act of all of this in June of 1709 is one of the pivotal battles of world history, the Battle of Poltava. if the Swedes win, Eastern Europe, including Russia, will be completely redrawn as countries, as societies. If Russia wins, then Russia becomes the dominant empire of Eastern and even Central Europe. The fact is that given the fact that Charles X did not receive from the Ukrainians what he expected, he is outmaneuvered, he is outgunned. Peter the Great's cannons make mincemeat out of the Swedish forces. And Charles X is wounded. And, at the front lines is largely rendered, irrelevant. Russia won. Ukraine lost. Sweden was never a great power again. Even Poland was never a great power again. Lithuania was never a great power again. Ukraine and the Cossacks were never a major factor in European life again. That's how serious this was. The gap will be filled with Prussia and then the growing Austrian Empire. That's how radical the Battle of Poltava was in 1709. Ukraine will not exist again as an independent country in any kind of real sense until the early 1990s. That's how serious, that's the intensity of the stuff we're talking about here. This is why I've dedicated my life to this stuff. I am an Orthodox man, a nationalist, a lover of Ukrainian culture. I mean, this is what happens. When you dedicate yourself to this, you feel the pain, you feel the agony. This is the nature of nationalist struggle against empire. Whether it be, I don't know, Poland or the New World Order, empire is empire. They are amoral. And it's by this suffering, it's by this pain, by this depopulation. Ukraine will be radically depopulated. Genocide will be the order of the day. Up until the middle of the 19th century. This is what we have at stake. This is what nationalism is. It is the negation of empire. It is the negation of the New World Order. It is the negation of oligarchy. Whether you're talking about Ireland or Ukraine, it's the same struggle. It's the same movement. It's the same ethical idea. And that's what this program is dedicated to. And this is what I am dedicated to in God's name. So I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for being a part of this program. I want to thank the Voice of Reason, Steve and Mike and everybody else. And I wish God's blessings on you. And I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com. So
You're tuned into Radio Aryan.